You know that feeling when you're just completely swamped?
Oh,
Like,
yeah.
there's just so much information coming at you, and all you really want is for someone to just distill it, give you the important stuff.
Absolutely. It's like drinking from a fire hose sometimes, isn't it? Trying to figure out what actually matters versus, just noise.
Totally. And getting that clarity, really understanding something without getting lost, that feels like a superpower these days.
It really does.
And that's kind of the whole idea behind the deep dive, right?
Yeah.
You, the listener, send us sources, articles, bits of books, whatever's grabbed your interest, and we dive in.
Yeah, we sift through it, try to pull out the core ideas, the real takeaways.
And hopefully present it in a way that's clear, maybe even a little bit engaging. Think of us as your, I don't know, slightly nerdy guides through the stuff you want to know more about.
And for this deep dive, you sent over some really fascinating material on Anapanasati.
Right, mindfulness of breathing.
Exactly. We've got a pretty comprehensive Wikipedia overview, plus some excerpts from different writings that really dig into why it's so significant.
Yeah, so our mission today for you listening is to really unpack Anapanasati. We want to get beyond just, okay, follow your breath.
Right. What does it really mean? How has it been practiced, understood across different times and cultures?
And crucially, why might it matter to you today? Because this isn't just some, fleeting wellness trend. It's got incredibly deep roots.
And potentially some real benefits. There are layers here.
Okay, so let's dive in then. Anapanasati. What are we actually talking about? What's the core definition?
Well, the name itself is a great starting point. It's Pali, right? An ancient Indian language.
Okay.
So Anapanana, that literally means inhalation and exhalation. The breath coming in, the breath going out.
Simple enough, in and out.
And then sati, that translates to mindfulness, awareness, presence.
Got it. So Anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing in and out.
That's the essence of it, paying deliberate attention to the breath. Seems pretty straightforward on the surface, doesn't it?
It does. But clearly there's more to it, given its importance.
Oh, absolutely. The sources really emphasize that this isn't just like one technique among many. In Buddhism, it's often seen as the quintessential form of meditation.
And it goes way back.
Right back to Gautama Buddha himself, according to the tradition. Our sources point specifically to the Anapanasati Sutta, that's a key text in the Pali Canon as like the foundational guide.
Okay, the Anapanasati Sutta, and it's popped up everywhere since then.
It really has. It's fundamental in Theravada Buddhism, places like Sri Lanka, Thailand, but also in Zen in Japanese traditions, in the Tiantai school in China, Tibetan Buddhism uses it. And of course, it's a massive part of modern secular mindfulness programs in the West.
Wow. So it's like this common thread weaving through centuries and across continents.
Exactly. One source called it probably the most widely used Buddhist method for contemplating the body, both historically and, well, right now. Which is pretty amazing when you think about it all centered on just breathing.
Okay, so we get what it is, but how do you actually do it? What are the instructions based on these sources? How would someone start?
Well, that Anapanasati Sutta gives some pretty clear starting points. It basically says, find a quiet place.
Like the classic image, under a tree or something.
Yeah, gone to the forest or to the root of a tree or to an empty place is the traditional phrasing. Or just, a quiet room works too.
Okay.
And then you sit down, ideally cross-legged, the sources say, with your back straight but not stiff, stable,
Nice
relaxed.
to good posture.
And then the core instruction, you bring your attention to your breath. Right there at the forefront of your awareness, just watch it.
Just watch it flow in and out naturally.
Exactly. But it's not just passive noticing, as you hinted earlier. There are specific things to tune into, contemplations.
Okay. Like,
Let
wait a
go. Well, first, just discerning. Is this a long breath or a short breath? You just notice that distinction.
Okay, long or short, got it.
Then, trying to experience the whole body of the breath, feeling it from the very beginning of the inhale all the way through to the very end of the exhale, beginning, middle, end.
So really mapping the entire cycle.
Precisely. And then there's this phrase, calming bodily fabrication.
Calming bodily fabrication. What does that mean?
It sounds a bit technical, but think of it as like allowing the breath to become naturally smoother, more tranquil, letting the physical process of breathing settle down.
So you're not forcing it, but you're allowing it to become calm.
Exactly. It's about sensitivity to the breath, the body, but also to what arises with the breath.
Like feelings and thoughts.
Yeah, the sources talk about training yourself to be sensitive to rapture or joy that might come up, to pleasure, to the mind itself. Is it focused? Is it wandering? And to mental processes generally.
So the breath is like your home base, your anchor, but you're also aware of everything else happening internally.
That's a good way to put it. And the training goes even deeper. There's reflecting on things like inconstancy, you know, how everything is always changing, including the breath.
Impermanence.
Right. Right. And dispassion, cessation, relinquishment, basically, learning to let go of clinging.
Wow. Okay. That's starting to sound pretty profound.
It is. The practice also involves steadying the mind, satisfying the mind, releasing the mind. It's a whole path unfolding.
And the ultimate promise here, according to these texts, what's the big goal?
Well, the sources are pretty clear. Developing mindfulness through Anapanasati is seen as the direct path to overcoming suffering, dukkha, and reaching enlightenment, or nirvana.
Just through the breath. That's quite something.
It is. There's this great simile used in one text to describe the attention needed. It compares the meditator to a clever turner, like a woodworker using a lathe.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, totally focused, feeling the material, making tiny adjustments, just completely absorbed. That's the kind of attentive presence you bring to the breath.
Okay, that makes it feel more tangible. Not just floating awareness, but focused skill.
Right. And through that close watching, you start to really understand the arising and ceasing of each breath, moment by moment.
And that leads to insight.
Yeah, the idea is you realize experientially that the body is just the body. These sensations are just sensations. They come and go. There isn't some solid, unchanging me in charge of it all.
Seeing through the illusion of a separate self.
That's a key part of it, a crucial step towards reducing that sense of suffering, according to the teachings.
Okay, so that's the foundation laid out in those early scriptures.
Yeah.
But you mentioned things evolved. Our Wikipedia source talked about later developments.
Yes, exactly. A very common method emerged later, especially in the Theravada tradition, often called the four-stage method. It's quite practical.
Four stages. How does that work?
It often starts with counting. You count your exhalations 1, 2, 3, up to 10, then start over.
Okay, counting out breaths.
Right. Once you can do that pretty consistently without your mind wandering off and losing count.
Which happens.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Then you might switch to counting the inhalations, again, 1 to 10.
In breaths this time.
Yeah. Then the third stage is to drop the counting altogether and just focus purely on the sensation of the breath, feeling it move.
It's just the raw feeling.
Exactly. And the fourth stage is often about refining that focus even more, narrowing it down to one specific spot where the sensation is clearest.
Like at the tip of the nose or the upper lip.
Precisely. That area where you can feel the air passing in and out.
Counting seems like such a common starting point in meditation.
Yeah.
It gives the mind something concrete to hold on to, right?
It really does. And this counting method is laid out very clearly in Buddhaghosa's Visuddhimagga, which is a hugely influential Theravada commentary.
Okay, so it's big in Theravada.
But interestingly, it's not just Theravada. Counting breaths up to 10 also appears in earlier Mahayana texts, like Vasubandhu's Abhidharmakoshagarika.
Oh, really? So it's around before Buddhaghosa too?
Seems like it. And even those very early Buddhist texts translated into Chinese, the Dhyana Sutras, which were based on practices from other Indian schools, they also recommended breath counting.
Wow.
And those texts actually formed some of the bedrock for what later became Zen. So yeah, counting has a long and surprisingly diverse history in Buddhism.
It's fascinating how that simple technique just kept proving useful across different schools and eras.
It really is. And those Dhyana Sutras didn't stop at counting. They outlined something called the six aspects or six means.
Six aspects, like more steps.
Kind of, yeah. Like a more detailed progression. Starts with counting, then pursuing, following the breath's path, then concentration on a specific spot.
Okay.
Then observation, which involves contemplating things like the four elements or the five aggregates, basically, analyzing experience, then turning away towards wholesome states. And finally, purification, which is said to mark entry into a higher stage of practice, like stream entry.
Whoa, okay. That's much more involved than just counting to 10.
Definitely a more elaborate map. Now, jumping forward to more modern times, we see some variations too.
Like how?
Well, that traditional focus on the nostrils or upper lip. The Burmese Vipassana movement, which has had a huge impact, often suggests focusing on the abdomen instead.
Feeling the rise and fall of the belly with the breath.
Yeah, exactly. And our sources say other contemporary teachers recommend that too. It's a very tangible sensation for many people.
Makes sense. Sometimes the nose-lip sensation can feel quite subtle.
It can. And modern teachers give lots of practical tips too. Set aside time, have an intention, practice sitting, standing, lying down, even walking.
So incorporating it into daily life more.
Potentially, yeah. Some teachers still emphasize that nostril upper lip focus. Others talk about the tendon, that point below the navel.
The tendon. That comes up in martial arts too, right? Like a center of gravity or energy.
That's the one. So there's this connection sometimes drawn between the breath, focus, and this sense of centeredness or stability.
Interesting. And counting is still popular in modern teaching.
Oh, yeah. Counting inhales, exhales, or both. Usually up to 10 and restart. And the key advice, always, is when your mind wanders, which it will.
Inevitably.
You just gently, without beating yourself up, bring your attention back to the breath.
That moment of return is crucial, isn't it?
It is. Philippe Golden, the neuroscientist, actually points out that the learning happens right there, noticing the distraction and consciously redirecting. That's strengthening the attention muscle.
So getting distracted isn't failing, it's actually part of the training process.
Exactly. Takes the pressure off trying to achieve some perfect blank mind state, which isn't really the point anyway.
Right. Now, something you touched on earlier. Is the breathing in Anapanasati meant to be totally natural? Are you ever supposed to, like, control it?
That's a really good question. And generally, for standard Anapanasati, it's passive observation.
Just letting it be.
Letting it be. Not trying to make it deeper or faster or slower. Just watching what's already happening. However, the Wikipedia source did mention some interesting exceptions in specific traditions where the breath is more actively engaged.
Oh, like what?
Well, think about Tibetan or Mongolian throat singing.
Right, that incredible sound.
A key part of that practice involves a very long, slow, controlled exhalation while chanting. The breath control is integral to the sound and the meditation.
Ah, okay, so the breath supports the chanting.
Exactly. And similarly, some Japanese Zen schools apparently emphasize developing strength in the tendon, that abdominal area, and use slow, deep out-breaths quite deliberately to help ground the mind.
So different goals, different ways of working with breath.
Precisely. There was also mention of a bamboo method, like punctuated breaths, more rhythmic. Mm. And then, of course, you have pranayama in yoga, which is a whole system dedicated to specific breath control techniques. Very different from passive Anapanasati.
Fascinating how versatile the breath is as a tool across different disciplines. Okay, so we have this ancient practice. What does modern science have to say? Are there measurable benefits?
Yeah, this is where it gets really compelling for a lot of people today. Science is definitely starting to explore this.
And finding what?
Well, research on focused attention meditation, which Anapanasati is a prime example of, suggests it can actually change the brain over time.
Change the brain? How?
Things like potentially increasing gray matter density in areas related to attention and self-awareness. It's like working out a muscle, the brain regions you use get stronger. Brain growth, basically. Mm.
Actual physical changes.
That's what some studies indicate. And functionally, there's evidence too. One study used the Stroop test, you know, where you see the word blue written in red ink and have to say the ink color.
Yeah, that messes with your head.
Right. It tests your ability to inhibit an automatic response. They found experienced meditators were better at it, showing less habitual reactive responding.
Which could translate to what? Less emotional reactivity in real life.
That's the implication, yeah. Better emotional regulation, maybe less impulsivity. Plus, other research suggests Anapanasati practice can enhance connectivity between different brain regions.
Making the brain work more efficiently, perhaps. More integrated.
That seems to be the idea. Better communication across networks. It's still an evolving field, but the evidence is mounting that these practices have tangible effects.
It's pretty amazing to see science starting to validate what these traditions have been saying for, well, millennia.
It really is.
Let's circle back to some of those specific traditions. You mentioned Theravada earlier. Our sources seem to indicate they have a particularly systematic approach.
They really do. The Abhidhamma, that's the sort of philosophical and psychological part of the Theravada canon, lays out this very detailed map. 16 stages of Anapanasati.
16 stages.
Yeah, organized into four groups of four. They call them tetrads.
Okay, four tetrads. What do they cover?
It's a progression. The first tetrad is all about the breath as a physical process, long, short breaths. The whole breath body, calming the breath. Focus on the body.
Right.
The second tetrad shifts to feelings, experiencing joy, pleasure, mental formations connected to the breath, and calming those formations. Focus on feelings.
Body, then feelings.
Then the third tetrad focuses on the mind itself, experiencing the mind, gladdening it, concentrating it, liberating it, all in relation to the breath. Focus on mind.
Okay.
And the fourth tetrad dives into Dhamma, which can mean mental qualities or phenomena contemplating impermanence, fading away of desire, cessation, letting go. Focus on mental objects or qualities.
Wow, that's incredibly structured. Body, feelings, mind, mental qualities.
It is. And the idea in the Abhidhamma is that in a dedicated session, you'd ideally work through these tetrads sequentially, starting with the first one each time. It's seen as this gradual deepening.
And our Wikipedia source had that table linking these tetrads to the four foundations of mindfulness, this Satipatthana. How does that connection work?
It maps really directly. The first tetrad, body focus, aligns perfectly with the first foundation, contemplation of the body.
Makes sense.
The second tetrad, feelings focus, aligns with the second foundation, contemplation of feelings.
Okay.
Third tetrad, mind focus, aligns with the third foundation, contemplation of mind or consciousness. And the fourth tetrad, Dhamma focus, aligns with the fourth foundation, contemplation of Dhamma's mental objects, qualities, the nature of reality. So you see, Anapanasati isn't separate. It's seen as a primary way into practicing the four foundations.
So it's like the breath is the vehicle for developing all these aspects of mindfulness in the Theravada view.
Exactly. It's deeply integrated. And modern Theravada teachers, according to our sources, often emphasize that Anapanasati, practiced diligently, can be enough on its own to lead all the way to enlightenment.
Really? On its own?
Yeah. Removing all the defilements, greed, hatred, delusion. There was that quote from Webu Sayadaw calling it a shortcut to Nibbana, accessible to everyone.
A shortcut? That's a strong claim.
It is. It really highlights the potential they see in just sticking with the breath. But they also mention it's often combined with other practices too.
Like what?
Like cultivating loving kindness, metta bhavana, or working with the other frames of reference, so it can be the core practice or part of a larger toolkit.
Got it. Okay, let's switch continents now. China. How did Anapanasati land there?
It's a really interesting story. It arrived early, like 2nd century CE. This monk, Anshigao, came from the West, probably Parthia, and was one of the very first to translate Buddhist texts into Chinese.
A real pioneer.
Totally. And one of the key texts he translated was an Anapanasati Sutra, a sutra specifically on mindfulness of breathing.
And people thought it was lost.
Yeah, for centuries. But then, incredibly, a copy of his original translation was rediscovered in Japan in 1999.
Wow. What did that tell us?
It gave huge insights into how the practice was first introduced. Then, a bit later, 4th century, another really important monk, Buddhashinga, or Fotudeng, came along.
Go ahead.
And he was known for teaching Anapanasati using breath counting. He apparently used it very effectively to help people calm their minds, achieve concentration, and he's credited with really helping Buddhism gain a foothold and spread widely in China.
So that counting method was key again in its initial spread in China.
Seems like it was a very accessible entry point. And as more texts got translated over time, different Anapanasati methods got woven into the fabric of Chinese Buddhism and even influenced native traditions like Taoism a bit.
That cross-pollination is fascinating.
It is. Then, fast forward to the 6th century, and you get the Tiantai school. They put a huge emphasis on Anapanasati.
Tiantai, what was their angle?
They integrated it deeply into their framework of shamatha and vipassana.
Calm and insight.
Exactly. Yeah. Shamatha being the calming, stabilizing part, and vipassana being the insight, wisdom part. And the founder, Zi, was incredibly systematic about it.
How so?
He actually classified different types of breathing.
Classifying breath? Seriously?
Yeah. Like panting breath that's agitated, not good for meditation, unhurried breath better but still coarse, then deep and quiet breath getting closer, and finally stillness or rest where the breath becomes incredibly subtle. That was the ideal. Yeah, Z taught that in deep meditation, the outer physical breathing might almost seem to stop, and a more subtle internal breath takes over. He wrote about this in detail in his major works.
That idea of internal breathing, we hear echoes of that elsewhere too.
We do. Even a much later Chen master, Kui Suan Hua, talked about the external breath reaching stillness and the internal breath becoming active in correct meditation.
So the Chinese tradition really took Anapanasati, analyzed it, systematized it, and made it central.
Absolutely. Became a cornerstone for many schools.
Okay, fascinating. Now, what about the Indo-Tibetan traditions? How does Anapanasati fit in there?
It's a bit more varied in Tibetan Buddhism. Often, it's seen as a foundational practice, something you do to calm the mind before engaging in other, maybe more complex tantric or visualization practices.
So more preparatory.
Often, yes. Though key Indian figures who influenced Tibet, like Asaga and Vaspandu, definitely wrote about Anapanasati as a profound practice leading to insight, to Vipassana.
But did their specific way of practicing it get fully transmitted?
That's where there's some scholarly discussion. Did the full experiential lineage make it to Tibet? Maybe not entirely directly in all cases.
Okay.
So consequently, the Gelug school, the Dalai Lama's lineage, the largest one, generally tends to view Anapanasati mainly as that preparatory step, essential for settling the mind, but maybe not the primary vehicle for the deepest insights itself.
Kind of like tuning the instrument before playing the piece.
That's a perfect analogy for the Gelug view, yeah.
Yeah.
Which contrasts, remember, with that Theravada view of it being potentially the whole path.
Right, different emphasis. Mm. But you said it's varied in Tibet.
Yes, because the Kagyu and Nyingma traditions, two other major schools, often see it differently. They tend to view mindfulness based on Anapanasati as actually a very profound gateway to their highest practices, like Mahamudra and Dzogchen.
Practices aimed at direct realization of the nature of mind.
Exactly. For them, especially in Mahamudra, Anapanasati can be the perfect bridge. You start with the breath, then you shift to observing the mind itself using that stability you've cultivated.
Ah, so it's a launching pad for observing the observer.
You could say that. Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, who was Kagyu and Nyingma, had that great line about the breath being a portrait of your mind. It reflects everything.
I like that.
And even in some complex tantric traditions like the Panyakakrama, breath counting might be used right at the beginning, potentially sparking insight within that specific tantric context.
So a real spectrum of views in Tibet, from essential preparation to profound gateway, depending on the school.
Exactly. It really shows how adaptable this core practice is.
Okay, we've journeyed through history and across traditions. Mm-hmm. Let's ground this again. For someone listening now wanting to maybe try this, what are the absolute basics, the practical foundations we've pulled from all this?
Right, distilling it down. First, find that quiet space, undisturbed.
Yeah.
Second, find a stable, comfortable posture. Seated is typical. Spine upright but relaxed. Hands resting, maybe in the lap, eyes gently closed or softly gazing down.
Got it. Posture.
Third, and this is key, bring your attention to the sensation of the breath. Usually the tip of the nose or the little area above the upper lip, wherever you feel that slight sensation of air moving in and out most clearly.
Okay, find the spot.
And fourth, just observe. Watch the natural breath. Don't force it. Don't control it. Just feel it. Long breaths, short breaths, the whole cycle, beginning, middle, end, just witness it.
Simple observation. And what about those eight stages you mentioned earlier from one source? Counting, following, contact. Are those essential starting out?
They represent a potential path of refinement. Counting can definitely help initially to steady the mind. Following the breath's path, becoming more sensitive at the contact point, fixing the attention. These show how concentration can deepen.
And the later stages? Observing, turning away, purification.
Those point towards the arising of insight, the vipassana, observing the breath's impermanence, letting go of distractions, calming mental hindrances like restlessness or doubt. Retrospection is looking back and understanding the process.
But the main message is you don't have to conquer all eight stages immediately.
Absolutely not. Benefits come even from the early stages. Just the act of bringing your attention back again and again is powerful.
Right. And as that concentration gets stronger, what happens then?
The sources suggest the breath can become very fine, very subtle. You might enter states of deep calm and absorption, the jhanas.
Deep meditative states?
Yeah. And it's often from that stability, that stillness, that real insight vipassana naturally starts to emerge.
Insight into?
Impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, or dukkha, not self. Seeing these not just as ideas, but as the actual nature of experience.
An experiential understanding, not just intellectual.
Exactly. And the path can continue through further stages of purification, seeing arising and passing ever more clearly, seeing the drawbacks of clinging, developing a powerful desire for freedom, and cultivating deep equanimity.
Leading ultimately towards?
Towards nibbana, liberation, becoming a lived reality, not just a distant goal. That's the highest potential described.
Wow. So starting with just noticing the breath of the nose,
yeah,
it's presented as a path that can lead all the way to the end of suffering.
That's the traditional framework, yes. Simple practice, profound potential.
Okay, so wrapping this up then.
Yeah.
The core of Anapanasati is really what? Just simple awareness of breath right here, right now.
That's the heart of it. Using this constant, readily available anchor your own breath to cultivate presence, focus, and eventually wisdom.
And connecting back to that feeling we started with, being overwhelmed, swamped by information, this feels like a remarkably accessible tool.
It really does. Something you can return to anytime, anywhere, just to ground yourself in the present moment, find a bit of clarity amidst the chaos.
So hopefully this deep dive has given everyone listening a clearer picture of Anapanasati, its meaning, its history, its practice, its potential.
Yeah, a foundation maybe for further exploration, because ultimately reading about it or hearing about it is one thing.
The real understanding comes from trying it out yourself.
Exactly. Direct experience is the key.
Right. So maybe a final thought for our listeners to chew on, to explore for themselves. In the middle of your day, maybe even right now, how might just taking a few moments to really feel your breath change your experience of this present moment? What subtle things might you notice if you just paid gentle attention?
It's an invitation, really, an invitation to explore this simple ancient path and see where it might lead you.